This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America on this edition of the program. It was an aborted mutiny, but it has weakened Russian President Vladimir Putin. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. 1 week ago, a band of armed mercenaries under the leadership of Yevgeny Prigozhin swept through Russia, covering some 750 kilometers in a single day, according to The Economist magazine, and seized control of two major cities. The Wagner Group, Prigozhin's private mercenary military company, came within 200 kilometers of Moscow before withdrawing without incident. The Wagner mercenary group under Prigozhin, a longtime confidant of Putin, may operate separately from the Russian army, but make no mistake, it is a wholly owned subsidiary of the Kremlin. On this edition of the program, we will explore that heretofore symbiotic relationship which began to fray with the fateful decision by Vladimir Putin to invade Ukraine. According to Foreign Affairs magazine, Putin's invasion of Ukraine on February 24, 2022, has destroyed his mystique as an untouchable autocrat. Before that, Putin's aggressions in Syria, Crimea, and elsewhere may have rendered him unscrupulous and aggressive, but they also reflected crafty military strategy on his part. Then, per Foreign Affairs magazine, quote, in one stroke, he showed his ineptitude by invading a country that posed no threat to Russia and by failing again and again in his military enterprise, the latest example of which is the short-lived armed rebellion by Wagner Group leader Yevgeny Prigozhin, carried out last weekend, which has undermined Putin's autocrat mystique. The inimitable Economist magazine says this about Vladimir Putin, quote, whether Putin's fall comes soon or in months or in years, he stands revealed as a blunderer. He is not so much a czar as simply the top thug in the hollowed out gangland to which he has reduced Mother Russia, unquote. Well, for more on the significance and the implications of the aborted Wagner mutiny on Putin's grip on power and on the war in Ukraine, we turn to two distinguished experts. Mark Katz is professor in the Russian and Eurasian Studies program at George Mason University in the nearby state of Virginia, and Maria Snegovaya. She's a senior fellow with the Europe, Russia, and Eurasia program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. That's a prominent think tank based in Washington. And both panelists join me via Microsoft Teams. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
Maria Snegovaya, let me begin with you. Most analysts have said that this attempted mutiny by the Wagner Group and its leader, Yevgeny Prigozhin, has had the effect of weakening Vladimir Putin and his grip on power. I mean, let's face it, for months he had been, that is, Prigozhin, carrying out public spats with the leadership of Russia's military forces. He was undermining Putin's official justifications for the war. And yet it appears that Moscow was taken by surprise by this attempted mutiny. First of all, how do you see this whole attempt by Prigozhin and the effect on Putin?
Yeah, I certainly agree with this conclusion that the mutiny has exposed unexpectedly somewhat radical weaknesses within the Putin system. Well, the very fact that an armed battalion can march all the way within 120 miles of Russia's capital without hardly facing any resistance, certainly shows that Putin is not completely in control of his power vertical, something that has been, frankly, one of Putin's key points since the start of his career as Russia's president. Having said that, we don't really understand, and it's important, I think, to keep in mind the informational limitations that we've got at the moment. We don't really understand very clearly what the reasons that prompted Prigozhin to do what he's done and what he was trying to achieve in the first place. Based on that understanding that we've got at the moment, he had very serious tensions, disagreements with Russia's Ministry of Defense, and in particular, it had Sergei Shoigu. As a result, apparently, he wanted to make certain statement, a point. Allegedly, he planned this mutiny ahead of time, but also, according to these multiple leaks that we've got, his original plan was exposed. He allegedly planned to capture Shoigu, maybe, and then maybe make that statement. As a result, essentially, he had to improvise. And the improvisation led him unexpectedly somewhat to expose these radical weaknesses within Putin's systems. Going forward, the fact that we now see that the Kremlin is hardly able to defend itself, and the fact that at the moment when Putin faces such fundamental challenge and threat, the elites, the closest circles to Putin, remain silent and not at all eager to stand up to his defense. defense, and so are the security services, and they keep waiting for orders that will come from the top. That actually shows that Putin is not in full control of his own country. And certainly going forward, that creates all sorts of incentives for all sorts of actors who are also quite resentful about Putin's 23-plus years rule. And this war, where Russia is not very successful, to say the least, certainly creates a lot of incentives for them to try and challenge Putin going forward. So this is just a beginning, I'd say, of what is going to be a very interesting development.
Turning to you, Professor Katz, a very interesting development and just the beginning of that. What would you like to add or supplement to what we learned from Maria Snegovaya with regard to Prigozhin's objective, the fact that it appears that this so-called mutiny definitely exposed a vulnerability in Putin's regime and his hold on power with respect to the elites being silent, etc.? This is a fascinating observation.
It is indeed. And it seems to me that Prigozhin, at least in his own mind, and if we take him at his word, his intent was not to overthrow Vladimir Putin. Basically, that this mutiny was against his rival in the defense ministry, whom Prigozhin has blamed for prosecuting the war in Ukraine poorly. And basically, what he wanted to do was to get rid of Shoigu, get rid of the chief of the general staff, Gerasimov, and that he and Putin, you know, would be able to work together. But also, during the rebellion, Prigozhin made the statement that the whole justification for the war against Ukraine was incorrect, that Ukraine did not pose a threat to Russia, and that he gave Putin even a way out of it. In other words, that he blamed the greedy generals for this war. And if Putin had taken this up, it would have been a way out. Yes, I was fooled by these bad people, and now we can proceed along more reasonable lines. But Putin, of course, wouldn't do this. That for Putin, this war against Ukraine is something that I think is deeply important for him. He really does regard Ukraine as rightfully belonging to Russia, believes that Ukrainians are really Russians, and anyone who thinks differently is obviously a fascist. He cannot give up on this conflict. And I think that basically when it became clear that Putin was not going to go along with Prigozhin's efforts, then, you know, Prigozhin bowed out. And incredibly enough, you can rebel against the state, and yet you can go off to Belarus in retirement, if you will. It's just remarkable. And I think, as Maria pointed out, no one seemed to be willing to stop Prigozhin, that he wasn't really challenged. And that this, I think, reveals an even greater problem. Because let's face it, Prigozhin is not someone whom I think a lot of Russians would want to be ruled by. He even makes Putin look a little more reasonable in comparison. And so I think that, you know, although no one stopped him, no one really joined him either. That we've seen in a lot of military rebellions, when a key commander moves, then other people join him. This didn't happen either. And so I think he got scared and he decided to go off. But I think what it does is it opens the door to a regular unit commander, someone from the regular armed forces, to do something similar and may have a lot more support the next time around. And I think that people see that part of this deal between Lukashenko, the Belarusian leader, Putin, and Prigozhin was that those Wagner fighters who did not want to sign the defense ministry contract could go off with Prigozhin to Belarus. Now, whether this is going to work out that way or not, I don't know. But I would think that if I were part of the regular Russian army and I see fighting on the Ukrainian front and you see very high casualties and you see the Wagner forces being able to get out of fighting, I think that that would sound pretty good to me, that I wouldn't mind having a similar opportunity. And so I think that this whole episode has only served to undermine the armed forces. And it's going to occur to someone that maybe we can do a better job than Prigozhin at this. And Putin might fire people whom he thinks have not behaved correctly or didn't support him enough. The problem I think Putin faces is that, yeah, you can get rid of a lot of people whom you don't trust, but who do you replace them with? Can you trust them anymore? And so I think that Putin now has a bigger problem than the war in Ukraine not going well. He has a problem with just how reliable his own security forces are and how much can he trust them.
Very fascinating insights by you both. We're going to take a short break and be right back. You are listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Professor Mark Katz, from whom you just heard. He's professor in the Russian and Eurasian Studies program at George Mason University, and Maria Snegovaya. She's a senior fellow for Russia and Eurasia with the Europe, Russia, and Eurasian program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And we're discussing instability in the Kremlin flowing from the mercenary Wagner Group's aborted mutiny. This is a reminder reminder that Our Encounter podcast is available on most of your favorite podcast apps. You may also download the show at voaafrica.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter at @Carol_Castiel or connect with us on Facebook at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Here's a shout out to a loyal Facebook fan, Sylvester Michael Sr. from Malawi. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Back to Maria Snirgovaya to talk about Russia once again. Maria, both of you raised so many fascinating questions with respect to instability in Russia, instability within the military, the fate of the Wagner Group and its soldiers. We understand from what Mark Katz said, the Wagner Group was supposed to merge or something like that with the military. Talk about that. And also, what is the relationship between the Wagner Group and the Kremlin? I mean, it's been described as a private military company. Others think it's, you know, and I think it's more accurate, it's a criminal network, but it has always been linked to the Kremlin, even if they've tried to deny this linkage. Up until the invasion of Ukraine, it had supported rogue regimes from Syria to Africa. Talk about the genesis of the group and Putin's relationship with Prigozhin and this symbiotic relationship between the Wagner Group and the Kremlin.
Certainly, it's essentially a group, a structure that deliberately is created by the Kremlin at the time under these auspices of independence to implement some of the actions, activities in or outside of Russia, to which the Kremlin at the time did not want to be directly associated. Like maybe some military support of certain dictators, Assad comes to mind, but in Libya and also across Africa, Wagner has been very effective. So while in the past Putin repeatedly said that Wagner is its own thing and has nothing to do with the Kremlin, just recently, in a complete radical turnaround, he actually accepted that Wagner has been historically funded by the Kremlin. Over the years, though, Prigozhin's personality, he is quite charismatic and I'd say also perhaps not very stable personality, also with a lot of ambition, obviously. So it made Wagner a little bit more of its own thing because of Prigozhin. He wanted Wagner to do certain activities, to implement certain actions that were beneficial for him personally. And for example, we know that in Africa, Prigozhin and his Wagner structures have made a lot of money when, for example, they occupied and controlled certain lucrative mines in that region. So over the years, Wagner, while still being funded by the Kremlin and certainly acting often on the orders of the Kremlin, also started developing its own sort of activities. And in some ways, I think it played this bad joke with Prigozhin. So he got a little bit too independent, sort of a little bit lost the sense of control. And this has become particularly visible during this war in Ukraine, where Wagner was effectively sent to Bakhmut to distract Ukrainians, possibly the Kremlin wanted to delay the Ukrainian counteroffensive by a little bit, and Wagner essentially played an instrumental role in that regard in Bakhmut and took a lot of losses because Russia's campaign is highly inefficient, and effectively what the Kremlin is doing is it's sending all this cannon fodder, armed but also poorly trained Russian soldiers, to counter Ukrainians. And Wagner got very upset about how things were unraveled, and because of who he is, starting publicly complaining about it by, among other things, publishing these videos in which he screams and yells and calls multiple Russian generals' names, trying to draw attention to this miserable state of his army, the lack of ammunition, etc., etc. And at first, as usual with Putin, he tolerated that situation. As a matter of fact, he may have welcomed it since Wagner acted as counterbalance to the Russian army. But at some point, it escalated. And eventually, there was this decision made, as Mark has pointed out, to incorporate Wagner into Russia's formal institutional army structures in order to take him under control. And this is probably what was the last straw for Prigozhin, who decided to then do this mutiny. At first, he planned to maybe arrest, capture the Russian Minister of Defense, but it evolved as the situation unraveled. So that's essentially the basic history. And it's funny that, as often the case with multiple mutinies and coups, based on what we know historically, it was specifically the attempt by the state to take this group under control that actually led to this escalation. But going forward, I wanted to point out that while the risks for the regime are now high because the weaknesses of the regime have been exposed, Wagner is also unlike most of other private military contractors that are there, just because it's one of the most experienced, best equipped and best trained military groups in Russia. So while others will maybe attempt to repeat Prigozhin's escapades, it's not very clear how successful they'll be, given that Wagner is by far the most best trained.
Thank you so much. Maria, back to you, Mark Katz, because it picks up on some of the points you were making in your previous remarks. What's going to happen now? Will these groups be merged? I saw where Lavrov is traveling around their client states, Syria and various parts of Africa, saying, okay, not to worry, we're going to still support you, i.e. the Russian military. What is the outcome of this? Will it merge? And then, you know, what about the fate of Prigozhin? Do we know he's in Belarus? You know, he's not like, you know, most critics. You know, he's not a cosmopolitan reformer that Putin feared. He's an ultra-nationalist illiberal, which is, I guess, not quite what Putin thought would bring him down. Not that he's been brought down yet, but he has been weakened. What can you say about those things?
These are all good questions. Certainly, the question of Wagner's operations in the Middle East and Africa are uncertain. The New York Times reported that in Syria, regular Russian armed forces have surrounded Wagner forces to help encourage them all to sign the contract with the defense ministry. But in Africa, where Wagner forces are present, there really aren't regular Russian military forces. In other words, that the Russian military is not in a position to force Wagner fighters to knuckle under. On the other hand, you know, it's not clear that everyone in Wagner has the same interests as Prigozhin. And it may be also that local Wagner commanders may be able to either work out some kind of deal with Moscow to bypass Prigozhin, or they can just work with certain African governments, especially the Central African Republic, which Wagner is reported to have a lot of sources of income in return for protecting the government there. Same with in Mali also. In other words, these forces may be able to become more independent of Moscow. On the other hand, Moscow does fund them to a certain degree, and there's going to have to be some kind of deal made. And it seems to me that the best thing to do would be to work with the people on the ground. And the real question is, will Prigozhin have any control over them? And I think that Moscow would be willing to let these Wagner commanders on the ground work with them. In other words, they can bypass Prigozhin. They don't necessarily have to remain loyal to Prigozhin. And so then that leads to your other question, the future of Prigozhin. And this, of course, is just not at all clear. Certainly Putin in the past, a number of his political opponents have met with very unfortunate accidents. They've fallen out of windows or they've drunk something that wasn't healthy for them. It wouldn't be surprising if Prigozhin is subject to an attempt like this. On the other hand, he is wiser to Putin's tricks than everybody else. Who knows? But certainly the Belarusian leader, Lukashenko, seems to be welcoming Prigozhin, has said that Wagner fighters can train Belarusian forces. In other words, that Lukashenko might be using this whole episode as a means to gain a little bit of leverage over Moscow, that it's not just Moscow that calls the shots, that now maybe Lukashenko also has some aces up his sleeve. The situation, I think, is just very confused. And certainly from the point of a dictator like Putin, none of this is welcome. You don't want any kind of uncertainty in terms of who is actually in control of what when you had been in control of absolutely everything before. And I think that Putin is going to have to spend a lot of effort dealing with this issue when he should be focusing on other things, including the war in Ukraine. This is a distraction from that. It's not going to improve Russian military prospects in Ukraine. And certainly, it's already heartened the Ukrainians that they seem to see that there is hope. In other words, that I think one of the things that Putin has hoped for is that Western support for Ukraine would diminish, that the West would become tired. And I think that on the Ukrainian side, what they're hoping is that the Russian armed forces will at some point buckle, just like in World War I, when the Tsarist forces crumbled, basically, with a lot of Bolshevik encouragement. There are possibilities now that have arisen that didn't seem likely before. There's, if he continues the war, that's bad. If he ends the war, he'll look bad. But continuing the war may lead to further risks, further Prigozhins. And so it just doesn't look very good for Putin at all. And I think for African governments that have decided that they could rely on Wagner, they could rely on Russia, that somehow Wagner was a more stable source of support against their internal opponents than Western forces, I think that they need to be really thinking hard right now, is that is Wagner actually going to be able to help them, or is the internecine Russian political complex going to undermine what Wagner can do for them? Did they make the wrong bet in relying on Wagner instead of the West?
Some very fascinating insights by Mark Katz, Maria Snigovaya. But I want you to pick up with respect to this internal power struggle in Russia. It is distracting from Russia's war effort in Ukraine. So the question is, will this have an effect on the war in Ukraine? Does it weaken Russia and give some leverage to Ukraine during its counteroffensive?
Thank you, Carol. So on the war, while originally there were hopes that the destruction will assist Ukraine on the ground, unfortunately, Wagner, as I mentioned before, has played a fairly limited instrumental role. The presence of Wagner in Ukraine is not crucial, really, for the Russian army, and they were frankly used as a distraction in Bakhmut. So from that perspective, the situation did not radically change. With now Wagner maybe weakened, this institutional rearrangement is unraveling, and they're replacing maybe Prigozhin leadership with somebody else's. There's also a lot of talk right now about the fact that these groups have been concentrated in Belarus and what it means for a possibility of another alleged counteroffensive against Kyiv. I think we need to keep watching the situation. It's not very clear as to whether these Wagner troops currently relocated to Belarus will or will not be used by the Kremlin going forward. I'd say one thing, it doesn't strike me as a great idea to use a rebellious battalion immediately in action, right? Because it's not very easy to predict how they're going to act at the moment. I would say that normally Kremlin should wait and until it's able to successfully integrate Wagner into Russian army structures and take it under full control. The other factor is the public opinion that we can see potentially maybe Russians start taking away their support from Putin. But Russians in this situation acted very much like the elites. That is, they were waiting to see who's going to be the winner in this situation. It's like outside observers rather than actors. But while the public opinion, I think, will remain passive and essentially just follow the lead that's promoted by state TV channels, what really matters in this situation is how the elites will see the situation, and will they trust these official narratives? I don't think so. They have much better information than the rest of the society, and they've seen with their own eyes that the Kremlin is weakened, the power vertical is hollow, and the emperor has no clothes. And now that the blood is in the water, we can expect a lot of sharks, other elite members who are not very happy with Putin, to come and try to seize the opportunity again.
I enjoyed Maria's metaphors there. Sharks circling. But you get the last word, Mark Katz.
Well, I think certainly with regard to Russian public opinion, the Chicago Council on Global Affairs has done work with the Levada Center in Moscow on public opinion about the war. And one thing they found is that while there seems to be growing public support in Russia for ending the war, the Russian public does not want to give back to Ukraine territory that Russian forces now occupy. Russians tend to regard this territory as actually part of Russia. And I don't think it will change so long as the cost to ordinary Russians are not extreme. I think that was part of the great thing that Prigozhin did, was that by recruiting from the prisons, he basically allowed for the conscription not to be as extensive as it was. And I think the issue now is that if Wagner forces are not there, I think Maria is right, their role was not as great as advertised, but still, will they need to bring in more conscripts? And I think that would be the Achilles heel. Now, you mentioned, Carol, the whole question of Africa as well, and I alluded to that. And one thing I think that certainly the African peacekeeping mission, the president of South Africa and other countries visiting both Ukraine and Russia recently, I think that they learned an awful lot about this. They went to Moscow, and you know, reportedly Putin treated them pretty rudely, interrupted their speeches, made clear he wasn't interested in their initiative or their concerns about grain prices in Africa. And I think one of the things that I think the West could do more successfully is point out to Africans that Russia is to Ukraine what Britain and France were to Africa. There was a colonial power. And the difference is that what Russia is now trying to do after Ukraine has been independent is essentially it's as if the British and the French now came back and wanted to reclaim some of their colonies in Africa. That's what the similarities basically are. And I think that the West needs to do far more than it has done to portray the reality that, you know, Russia was also a European colonial power, just that it was over land instead of overseas, and that this whole whole conflict has to do with decolonization. This is a message I think needs to be conveyed to Africans.
For now, that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my terrific guest, Mark Katz, professor in the Russian and Eurasian Studies program at George Mason University, and Maria Snegovaya. She's a senior fellow with the Europe, Russia, and Eurasia program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.